Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Shruta Pratyaksha Gocharam. Atma Shustam Idam Dishvam. Anva Vishva Svashakti Be. Iyate Bahudha Brahman. Shruta Pratyaksha Gocharam. Atma Shustam Idam Dishvam. Anva Vishya Svashakti Be. Iyate Bahudha Brahman. Shruta Pratyaksha Gocharam. Shustam, created by you, Idam, this, Vishvam, universe, Anvavishya, subsequently entering, Sva, with your own, Shaktibi, energies, Iyate, you are perceived, Bahudha, manifold, Brahman, O Supreme, Shruta, by hearing from Scripture, Pratyaksha, and by direct perception, Gocharam, knowable. Translation purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. O Supreme Absolute Truth, with your personal energies, you create this universe and then enter into it. Thus, one can perceive you in many different forms by hearing from authorities and by direct experience. Report. The grammatical agreement of Shruta Pratyaksha Gocharam in the neuter case and Atma Shristam Idam Vishvam indicates that the Supreme Lord, by entering his creation with his potencies, makes himself perceivable within the universe. Throughout the Bhagavatam and other authorized Vedic literature, we often find descriptions of the Lord's simultaneous supremacy over all other things and his identity with them. We cannot reasonably draw any other conclusion from Vedic literature than the one powerfully preached by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Achinta Veda Veda Tattva. That is, the absolute truth is greater than and distinct from everything, since he is the omnipotent creator and controller of all, and simultaneously one with everything, since all that exists is the expansion of his own power. Throughout these chapters of Srimad Bhagavatam, we also observe one of the unique, extraordinary features of this great work. Whether Krishna is sending his message to the gopis or accepting the prayers of Akura, there is constant philosophical discussion. Throughout the Bhagavatam, the steady combination of fascinating pastimes with persistent spiritual philosophy is an extraordinary feature. We are allowed to glimpse and even to relish the spiritual emotions of the Lord and his liberated associates And yet, we are constantly reminded of their ontological position, lest we lapse into a chief anthropomorphic vision. Thus, it is entirely in character with the work that Akura, in his ecstasy, glorifies the Lord with precise philosophical prayers. Om Gyanatam Randasya Ginajana Salakaya Shakshula Mitamina Tasma Shri Gurave Namaha Panchakalpatirubhishcha Kripasindhubhivacha Patitanu Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. Before I begin, I want to also offer my thanks and great appreciation for the incredible service and bhakti of all of the devotees who put on our most wonderful Radhashtami festival. I think from the very beginning, from Mangalarti to the ending kirtan, it was just ecstatic all the way through. And it's one of our most, I think, relishable and greatest attributes and qualities that we have here in New Ramanriti. We have such wonderful devotees that go all out to put on these very, very nice festivals. And of course, behind everything is Mother Mukya, who never gets too much credit when we're giving out all the credits for everything. And she's now on her way to a well-deserved rest and refreshment in India. And it's probably very much needed. So now we carry on. Anyway, back to the verse. It's interesting that it's almost like the authors here in the second paragraph, the second part of this purport, take a little aside and give a little reflection upon the Srimad Bhagavatam and its qualities that they're noting as we're going through these verses. I thought it was quite interesting. I've actually talked about the same idea myself in other classes and noted this very wonderful discussion of the complete presentation of Srimad Bhagavatam, that we have this interweaving of these wonderful pastimes of Krishna and his devotees with the deepest philosophy. And so it's very, very expertly done. So it's interesting that we just finished this rather interesting and, discussion of Krishna meeting with Kubja. We just kind of went through that, and now we're having the prayers of Akura, which are making sure that, maybe we turn this up, I think it's never loud enough. I have to get right up to it like this. And so Akura is making sure that we understand the right context. In other words, just in case you had any misconceptions about Krishna's relationship with Kubja, don't think this is anything material. Remember this position of Krishna as a supreme absolute. So we're getting this combination of hearing about Krishna's position, his glories, his wonderful activities, his omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent nature, and at the same time, these very relishable and beautiful pastimes are interspersed in the 10th canto. So it's also interesting, not just because we're getting philosophy and pastimes together, but the philosophy makes sure that we don't get an incorrect understanding. So we have this juxtaposition here of pastimes and philosophy, and it's done in such a way that we will always have the right understanding, the right attitude towards Krishna. This must have been Dravida who wrote this sentence, I imagine, when he was doing editing on this work. It says, yet we are constantly reminded of their ontological position, lest we lapse into a cheap anthropomorphic vision. Now, I hope nobody here is lapsing into a cheap anthropomorphic vision of Krishna and his pastimes. I thought I'd just look at this a little bit, and I actually took the opportunity of consulting with some of our great philosophical works like Dictionary.com and Wikipedia to understand a little bit more. Ontology. Ontology is defined as the philosophical study of the nature of being, existence, or reality, and it often characterizes objects in reality. Well, that's very appropriate. The ontological position, in other words, what is the reality of Krishna's existence? What is the nature of his being? That's exactly what's being described here. Ontology is throughout. It's a branch of metaphysics, which means the study of what is the meaning of things, the meaning of life, what's it all about, putting in lay terms, because I'm not really a philosopher. And ontology is more, into what is actually the nature of reality? What is existence? What is real? And so that's been described, the real position of Krishna, the living entities, material nature. And we do not want to have an anthropomorphic vision of Krishna. Anthropomorphic is described by dictionary.com as ascribing human form or attributes to a being or thing not human, especially to a deity. Excellent definition. In other words, our deity, of course, our supreme deity is Krishna, And if we attribute human attributes or human characteristics to him, then this is a great mistake. It's called anthropomorphism in philosophy. In other words, Krishna appears as a human being. He appears amongst us, and he performs activities which are, we should say, human-like in nature. But we have to always remember that we cannot put our understanding of being a human being, of being in a material body, having material minds, senses, intelligence, and think that Krishna is like that. That is a great mistake, and actually it'd be a very offensive mentality to think of Krishna as material. You know, this is actually one of the definitions of Mayavadi, isn't it? To attribute, to say that Krishna's body is Maya, that in other words, when he appears, he's just his material form. Reality, his essence is Brahman, everything is spiritual, and if he makes an appearance, that's just another part of Maya. So a very, very offensive mentality, and we don't want to think that. And we don't want to have a mundane conception where we think we can very easily enter into these pastimes because they're like our pastimes, or there's something, you know, that they're mundane or material. And Nagaraj Prabhu was talking about that in yesterday's class, a very nice class about Radharani, and was sort of warning us in a sense that we have to approach Srimati Radharani with great reverence and great respect and great care. That we don't think we just enter into these pastimes of Krishna and Radharani and Krishna and the gopis, but we have to be very respectful and understand that we probably don't understand these pastimes very well. They're really above our current level of realization, and we always have to be looking at this spiritual conception, the ontological reality of Krishna and his associates, and not take any type of anthropomorphic view. Okay. So to the verse here. It's saying that Krishna enters into the universe and thus makes himself perceivable. Now that's kind of interesting, because how is Krishna perceivable as he enters into the universe? Krishna simultaneously creates and enters the material world, but yet at the same time he remains separate and aloof as his essential spiritual form of Krishna. And as pointed out here in this purport, this is the essence of our Achinta Beta Beta Tattva philosophy. So this is, of course, a very deep philosophy enunciated by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but for the devotees, it's actually fairly simple. It's interesting, although it's considered to be like sort of the deepest, you know, you go through all the different philosophies and even of the Vaishnava Sampradayas, and they all add little bits of it. You know, there's the Tattvavadis and the Advaita-Dvaitas, and, you know, there's about four or five different ones. I looked it up and wrote it all down once, but I don't have it in front of me, so I can't remember it. But, you know, there's several progressions of philosophy that finally lead to the culmination of Lord Chaitanya's putting together Achinta Beta Beta Tattva, simultaneously one and different. So while this is the deepest philosophy, actually for the devotees, it's fairly simple. I don't find that devotees have too much trouble understanding the essence of this, because it simply says that Krishna pervades everything with his energies. Everything is coming from Krishna. Therefore, Krishna is one. But at the same time, he remains the complete whole. He doesn't lose his existence. He doesn't lose his identity. He still remains as Krishna, performing his pastimes in Goloka Vrindavan. At the same time, he manifests so many different qualities, so many different energies. He creates the material universe. Yet all types of spiritual manifestations. So we can understand that his energies are non-different from him. They have the full potency of him, but yet he remains apart from those energies, remains a complete whole, despite all of this expansion of his energies. So the Bhagavad Gita actually explains this very nicely in the ninth chapter, in chapters verses 4 through 10. I'm just going to read them through, because it's, you know, it's just stated wonderfully. It's Krishna's words, and therefore, how can it be improved upon? Krishna says, "By me and my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. And yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence." This is mystic opulence. That's the achinta part. Achinta means inconceivable. So Krishna is saying, this is his mystic opulence. It's an inconceivable energy. "Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not part of this cosmic manifestation, for myself is the very source of creation. Understand that as the mighty wind blowing everywhere rests always in the sky, all created beings rest in me. O Son of Kunti, at the end of the millennium, all material manifestations enter into my nature, and at the beginning of another millennium, by my own potency, I create them again. The whole cosmic order is under me. Under my will, it is automatically manifested again and again, and under my will, it is annihilated in the end. O Dhananjaya, all this work cannot bind me. I am ever detached from all of these material activities, seated as though neutral. And then in the 10th verse, Maya Dikshana Prakriti Suti Satcharacharam, Krishna confirms that he is the supreme controller of all of this, of all of these energies. He says, this material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O Son of Kunti, producing all moving and non-moving beings. Under its rule, this manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. So this is Krishna's position that he describes in the Bhagavad Gita and throughout the Vaishnava literatures. You know, how he creates, he maintains, he is a supreme controller. He enters into the universe. He's, in one sense, you could say he becomes part of it, or it's all part of him. It's all his energy, but yet he remains complete and separate. The prophet gives the example of a king, where he says, and it's a nice purport for 9.4. I don't think I'll read it all. But he says, for example, a king heads a government, which is but the manifestation of the king's energy. The different government departments are nothing but the energies of the king. Each department is resting on the king's power. But still, one cannot expect the king to be present in every department personally. So whoever, whether it's a king or whether whoever the government head is, in a sense, they appoint all the department heads, all the ministers, you know, all the different, you know, in the United States to be the Department of Agriculture, Department of Commerce, the Department of Defense. So in a sense, it's his energy, it's his will. He's appointing these people. He's creating the policies, giving them the policies. They're helping to carry it out. And so his energy, in a sense, is throughout that entire department and throughout the whole government, assuming he had a fair amount of power. Our presidents don't really have that much power, but a king would. But yet, at the same time, he's not there presently. He still remains in his palace, performing his activities and enjoying with his family and his queens and whatever. So in other words, it's an analogy to how Krishna, in the same way, by his energy, he creates everything. He has his deputed agents, the demigods, etc., take care of this material creation, but yet he remains in his own abode, enjoying with his devotees. So we can understand that Krishna is behind everything in this world, that he is the energetic source behind everything. Prabhupada gave the example of the light bulb in a powerhouse. In other words, if you see the light bulbs on, you might think, well, if you were ignorant or maybe a child, would think that the light is simply coming out of that bulb, that is the source. But yet we know that there are wires that go to it, and they go to the poles, and they go all the way back to the powerhouse, which is generating electricity, which is causing this manifestation of energy. So that example is given, how one who is intelligent understands the energetic source behind the external symptoms of energy. So how do we see Krishna? It's interesting because in this verse, it says Krishna is perceivable in his creation. Now, it's kind of interesting because, yeah, we can clearly see the creation. We can see the material elements. We can see all the forms that have been created in this material world. But yet, the verse doesn't explain this too much, but says that we understand Krishna as he enters in the universe by hearing from Scripture. Now that's kind of obvious. We know how we can understand by hearing from Scripture and get spiritual vision, but also by direct experience. The word is given here, prajaksha, which we know is one of the forms of knowing by direct experience. And we also know that that's very limited, using prajaksha to understand the absolute truth, if we're going by our material direct experience. But here it's saying a little bit different idea of prajaksha, that by direct experience we can understand Krishna as he manifests in this energy. Now, of course, it takes a little bit of spiritual vision. Obviously, the average person isn't looking at the material creation and saying, oh yes, there's Krishna, there's God. But yet, at the same time, many people do. Many people understand, just because of the greatness and the glory of this creation, people get a little idea or a glimpse that there must be something more. There must be something behind this, right? Even some non-devotees who are a little bit pious or a little spiritually inclined have this idea that Something must be greater than man. There must be some spiritual force or power or God, you know, that is behind all of this. Because even the material manifestation is incredible, is wonderful, is glorious, right? And Krishna says, you know, I'm the source of all of this. You know, all beautiful, mighty, glorious creations are but a spark of my splendor. So, you know, but that's the thing. The devotee knows it's only a spark, but knows that there's so much more of the spiritual world, the spiritual energy that Krishna has created. But anyway, how can we see this? Well, we get a little hint of this in the Bhagavad Gita in the 7th chapter. And there's a nice, little purport I'm going to read that's actually in the book On the Way to Krishna, that little book. It's very, very nice. And there's a chapter in this that says, Seeing Krishna Always. I think it's Seeing Krishna Always and Everywhere. It's the 3rd chapter of On the Way to Krishna. It's very, very nice description of how we can see Krishna. And he quotes 7:8, O son of Kunti, I am the taste of water, the light of the sun and the moon, the syllable om in the Vedic mantras. I am the sound and ether and ability in man. And Prabhupada says, in this verse, Sri Krishna is describing how we can become Krishna conscious fully in all stages of life. All living entities must drink water. The taste of water is so nice. When we are thirsty, nothing but water seems to do. No manufacturer can create the pure taste of water. We can thus remember Krishna or God when we drink water. No one can avoid drinking water every day of his life, so God consciousness is there. How can we forget? So in these ways, by taking these examples from Bhagavad Gita, we can see Krishna in everything. And similarly, he talks about the illumination. There's also Krishna and the light of the sun and the moon. In so many ways, we can see Krishna through his energies, through his working. And Prabhupada says, this is the process of Krishna consciousness. In this way, we can remember Krishna 24 hours a day, and this way, Krishna is with us. Of course, Krishna is always with us, but as soon as we remember this, his presence is factual and felt. So this is one of the ways that we begin to perceive Krishna in his material energy, as described in this verse, throughout by his creation. Now, the problem is that we don't really see Krishna all the time, and we don't see Krishna directly. Usually, we see Krishna more indirectly, like, you know, through his energies, the Vrata Purusha idea, like that. But we don't see Krishna so much directly in his original form of Shyamasundar. And that is because our vision is covered. In fact, Krishna even gives the energy which covers our vision. Everything is coming from Krishna, including the covering energy. So there's a nice example that Prabhupada gives of the clouds. There's a body of water, and the sun beats down on that body of water, evaporates the water, and creates clouds, right? So the clouds are the creation of the sun. From the energy of the sun, clouds come about. Now, when the sky is cloudy, we can't see the sun. In other words, the very creation, the creative energy which created the clouds now obscures the sun. So in the same way, Krishna creates this material energy, and through Krishna's Maya, we cannot see Krishna, because our eyes are covered by material energy, material desires, etc. In the same way, the sun is covered by the clouds. But on the other hand, often the sun will come out and burn away the clouds, and then we're able to easily see the sun. So by Krishna's mercy, he can clear away the clouds of our vision, clear away the dust of the mirror of the mind in such a way that we can see Krishna. So this is a cleansing process, the cleaning away the dust, and it's done by the process of bhakti. Prabhupada explains this a little from the teachings of Lord Kapila. Here's a purport. If we are devotees, lovers of God, the ointment of love will clear our eyes. In order to see God, we have to cleanse our eyes by wiping away the cataracts of material contamination. Although we may be eager to see God, we cannot see him with these material eyes. So material vision cannot approach God, cannot approach Krishna. Prabhupada once explained that just through the powers of our intellect, by the use of intelligence, if one is very, very intelligent and very thoughtful, one might come to the level of Brahman realization. In other words, one can understand almost like philosophically that one is different from the body, that one is spirit, soul, and reach kind of a Brahman understanding. But you cannot see Krishna in that way. You will not really approach Krishna through logic, you know, and through any type of mental understanding. It's only when Krishna purifies us and clears away the material contamination that we're able to see him. So that process is bhakti. Bhakti is the purifying process that qualifies us to understand Krishna. Krishna says, bhakti mam abhijananti yavanyaschasmi tatpataha tito mam tapito garva vishite tarnantaram. One can understand me as I am, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, only by devotional service. And when one is in full consciousness of me by such devotion, he can enter into the kingdom of God. Bhagavad Gita 18:55. So Krishna says repeatedly, it's also the last chapter of the last verse of the 11th chapter, very similar. It is only by bhakti that one is able to understand Krishna fully. Prabhupada says in the purport to Bhagavad Gita 11:52, Krishna is covered by his yoga maya potency. He is not to be seen or revealed to anyone and everyone. Only by one to whom he reveals himself can he be seen. This is confirmed in the Vedic literature. For one who is a surrendered soul, the absolute truth can actually be understood. The transcendentalist, by continuous Krishna consciousness and by devotional service to Krishna, can have his spiritual eyes open and can see Krishna by revelation. Interesting word, revelation. Christians use this word sometimes, but revelation is something that's also there in Krishna consciousness. Revelation comes from the word reveal. Through bhakti, Krishna reveals himself to devotees. So, how do we get that revelation? How do we enter into the purifying process to someday we'll be able to see Krishna? Devotional service begins with faith. Faith in Krishna Guru. In the Svetashvatara Upanishad, Yasha Devi Para Bhakti Rita Devi Tata Garao Taishaiti Katita Hyarta Prakashanti Mahatmana. Only unto those great souls who have implicit faith in both the Lord and the spiritual master are all the imports of Vedic knowledge automatically revealed. So in other words, it's not a mechanical process. It's a process of faith in Guru and following instructions of the Guru and faith in Krishna. So we need to have faith in both the Lord and the spiritual master, Krishna and Guru, together. And that faith leads to devotion, to bhakti, through all the different processes and stages of bhakti, to the point where all imports of Vedic knowledge will be revealed. So that is our process. Not a mechanical process. I read so much. I memorize so many slokas. I do so much quantity of service. No, those things are all good. You know, because those are acts of faith. In other words, we show Krishna our faith through practical service, through those acts. And when Krishna sees that, he sees that sincere attempt, he sees that bhakti, then he reveals knowledge to us. So, yeah, there is a process of sadhana, and it's a very exact process given by the spiritual master. But that process itself does not mechanically assure a certain result. It is through that process of sadhana that we are qualifying ourselves. We are showing Krishna our sincerity, and thus he awards us spiritual advancement. So, how does Krishna reveal himself to the devotee? Well, he reveals himself in many ways, even for neophyte devotees. And we begin to see Krishna little by little. And as we progress in Krishna consciousness, we get many realizations about Krishna. As is stated here, realizations or understanding of the philosophy is given through the heart. That's one way that we begin to understand Krishna and becomes more and more clear to us. As I said, when one is performing devotional service, very deep philosophy like a Chintabhaya Veda Tattva become quite simple. I mean, the devotee understands these things almost instinctively. You know, now, to a non-devotee, you know, it's like you would take a long time to try to get them to understand this, and they may not understand it all or get it. But, you know, but these points become simple to the devotee because our hearts has been purified, and therefore Krishna gives us knowledge through the heart. But the process of Krishna consciousness is not immediate. It takes some time, and it takes practice. However, sometimes Krishna gives some immediate taste of Krishna consciousness, of devotional service. The nectar of devotion ascribes there are 6 results of devotional service, and those first 2, the ability to destroy suffering, and that it awards all auspiciousness, is described by the acharyas that those 2 come about at the stage of sadhana. So even at the stage of sadhana, at the beginning stage of for devotional service, one experiences these first 2 results of devotional service, that suffering is destroyed. We see that cessation of suffering. We experience pleasure. We experience happiness in Krishna consciousness and auspiciousness. Again, auspiciousness means that we are appreciating Krishna. We are enjoying and experiencing the happiness of Krishna consciousness. So those things are there, even in the neophyte stage. Of course, the other 4 are there in the stage of bhava and prema. But at least these 2, immediately, we can begin to experience. So that's there. Krishna gives us a little taste, and he takes away our suffering right from the beginning. Now, devotees still sometimes experience suffering. That's a whole other class. But for now, we'll say that our basic suffering, that because the main suffering of identification with the body, going through the cycle of birth and death, that's eliminated. For a devotee, liberation is not a big thing. Now, pure devotional service is a big thing. That's a little more difficult. But actually, obtaining liberation is not that difficult, according to the scriptures. In fact, it's not even very important. Our aim is Krishna prema, pure devotional service. Now, sometimes, again, as I was saying, this immediate taste is given by Krishna. And this is experienced sometimes. Maybe some of you remember, you might have been just coming to Krishna consciousness, and maybe you were in a kirtan or went to a festival or something, and you might have felt some real ecstasy or happiness, or you really felt, anybody experienced that like right away? Okay, some hands up. Remember that early on? You didn't really know very much. You might not have even been following all the regular principles, or you may have been, you felt some real ecstasy or happiness in Krishna consciousness. So that's there. Now, it's actually a form of rati, which means attraction for Krishna, but it's called rati-abhasa, which means that it's not quite the same. It's more temporary. There's an interesting discussion of this for those who are interested in these things, technicalities, in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, 1-3, verses 44 through 51, which you can check out on your own. But it describes there that there's 2 types of this rati-abhasa, one called pratibimba, which is reflection, and one called chaya, which is defined as splendor. So it's interesting, I think, because some of us have experienced these things. Pratibimba means that there's symptoms even up to similar to bhava, like tears in the eyes and ecstasies like this, but there's still material attachment. It's a very early stage where one might experience this because it's described that this is reflection. Why is it reflection? It's a reflection of the bhakti of associating with pure devotees. So in other words, it's a reflection of Srila Prabhupada's bhava. In other words, if we engage in Krishna consciousness, we're doing some act of Krishna consciousness in association with the devotees of Srila Prabhupada, we're getting some of that reflection. This is described in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. It says it's reflection of the bhava of the pure devotees. So sometimes we are so fortunate that we get a little experience of that reflection. The other type is called chaya, which is an attraction to Krishna, very similar to rati, but it's not so much that one has material desires, but one is just not really purified or really at a higher stage. And sometimes it's described even by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Jiva Goswami in their purports here that this may appear during festivals. They actually mention this. They say if one is going to a festival of Krishna or one is associating with devotees or residing in the Dham, sometimes people go to Vrindavan or Mayapur and they just have these wonderful ecstatic experiences. I mean, I know people who were barely devotees, just joined, and they went to Vrindavan and they're practically in tears and experiencing really ecstatic symptoms. Now, that doesn't happen to all of us, but I have heard those reports from devotees. So what is this? This is chaya attachment or chaya rati. The problem is that it tends to be temporary. It may last for some time, but it's described that the taste is unstable. That's the word that's used. It's unstable. In other words, it may come, it may go. I mean, true bhava, true spiritual realization and advancement is steady. In other words, those come up after the stage of nishta, which is steadiness. So in other words, it doesn't come and go for a very, very advanced devotee. One is always in that stages. For devotees like us in lower stages, we have, you know, these moments and flashes of ecstasy and, you know, we have different experiences, but they're not steady. And that's because we're not purified yet. It's what we're experiencing is not pure devotional service, but it's these, another term also used sometimes is para attachment or shadow attachment. That's there. So there's these different forms of attachment or attraction to Krishna which are before the stage of purity. Now, the good part is that Bhaktivinoda Saraswati Sindhu 1.3.52, Rupa Goswami says that this unstable rati becomes deeper and becomes real bhava by the mercy of devotees. So as one continues in devotional service by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada and the pure devotees and all the acharyas in our line, one develops deeper and deeper realization to the point that it will not be unsteady or unstable at a certain point. And as we advance in Krishna consciousness, these experiences become very real and very steady. So we have to develop sort of from the unstable to the stable situation in Krishna consciousness. You know, we often heard this about becoming steady, you know, when we were new devotees. Now we're older devotees, we still need to hear about becoming steady in Krishna consciousness and steady in our practice, steady in our sadhana, because this will lead us to these higher stages of Krishna consciousness where these feelings that we experience, you know, like I was thinking, like, it was so ecstatic yesterday at Radhastami, you know, and in a kirtan particularly, just feeling the mercy of Radharani. But, you know, today I'm still feeling a little bit, tomorrow I'll feel a little bit less, and in 3 days I'll forget it. I mean, to be very honest here. You know, it's like that's the unsteady kind of, you know, level that we're at in devotional service. So we want to reach the point where that remains steady, where we're always experiencing this ecstasy of chanting Hare Krishna and the ecstasy of serving the deity. You know, but that's going to take some time. It's going to take the process of sadhana you know, for some of us, many years to reach that platform. One way that we can reach that platform more quickly is this idea of eagerness. We need to be eager to obtain Krishna. If we're complacent and we don't really care so much, or we're going about in sort of our humdrum way, another day, you know, another, you know, whatever, another 16 rounds, whatever, we're not going to make as much advancement. If one has to actually want to make advancement, it's kind of interesting because so many things that we in Krishna consciousness is about desire. Everything is about desire. You know, if we really desire Krishna, we'll get Krishna. Krishna rewards us according to our desire. If our desire is for material life, you know, we're going to get material life. If we have most of our situations, we have mixed desires. You know, it's called, you know, karma bhakta misha, jnana misha bhakta. It's we have mixed desires for fruitive results, for material sense gratification, along with genuine desires for bhakti. So it's kind of like we have to be working more and more, you know, to sort, you know, to give up those material desires and make the spiritual desires more strong. But one can do that if one is just eager and desires pure Krishna consciousness. In the Nectar Devotion, chapter 18, Prabhupada says, when one is sufficiently eager to achieve success in devotional service, that eagerness is called samutkanta. Another good word to learn. Samutkanta. This means complete eagerness. Actually, this eagerness is the price for achieving success in Krishna consciousness. There it is. Prabhupada says, this is the price. Everything has some value, and one has to pay the value before obtaining or possessing it. It is stated in the Vedic literature that to purchase the most valuable thing, Krishna consciousness, one has to develop intense eagerness for achieving success. So, one of the very nice, the wonderful things about these festivals is that they give us a little taste, and they give us some enthusiasm, and perhaps help us to increase that eagerness to advance in Krishna consciousness. And if we can take a little bit of that with us, then that's a great success. So I'll stop at that point. I'll go to Srila Prabhupada. Comments, questions? Any questions? I know Janmasmi has one. We'll see if anyone else has. Any of the ladies? Anyone? Okay, go ahead, Prabhupada.
there's a relevant verse in the 11th canto, 2nd chapter. It's the 42nd verse, which goes into this direct experience of the Lord. Bhakti Paresh Anubhava Varaktir Anitra Chaisha Chika Ekakala Prapadyamanas Prapadyamanasya Yatashnita Tushti Pushti Shurapaya Anugasam. This is like an analogy. I just gave class on it, but I just wanted to make a quick point. I'll just give the translation. Bhakti, or devotion, direct experience of the Supreme Lord, and detachment from everything else occurs simultaneously for one engaged in a process of bhakti. Just as when one's engaged in an eating process, pleasure, nourishment, and eradication of hunger occurs simultaneously and progressively as we eat. So this direct experience of the Supreme Lord. In the purporting, Gopi Prandan Prabhu makes the point that we get experience of the Lord in the area of protection. We feel His protection. And of course, for devotees, a lot of times it comes externally. You know, you almost have a head-on collision and say, Krishna, you know, and then somehow they get out of it. But there also seems to be, you know, Krishna presence is perceived, how He protects us from Maya, you know, keeps us on the track. And anyway, that was just, I thought about that a lot because I didn't expand it much. You know, Gopi always, he would always like directly, it would come from the acharyas. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you have some thoughts, you know, about how that direct perception of the Lord comes about through His protection.
I would say that's one of the ways, definitely. Experiencing the protection of the Lord, I've had personal experience of that. Probably many people, many devotees have had that, of being directly protected by the Lord. And that is actually a very good way that one perceives the Lord. I think that there are many ways, even sometimes a little more subtle or less dramatic than saying be protected by a head-on collision or whatever it might be, that one understands Krishna working in his life. And one thing that I guess just comment on that is Krishna's always working their life. He's always giving protection. He's always giving direction. He's always working to help us to advance in Krishna consciousness. Our job, our task, is to understand it, to see it. You know, Krishna's there, but we don't see Him. Krishna's helping us at every step, but we don't always see it or we don't acknowledge it. Sometimes there's, especially if there's something that seems to be not protection, but we're in some distress, or there's some difficulty in your life, we think, oh, Krishna's not there, or Krishna's abandoned us, or something like that. But actually, it's the opposite. Krishna's very much there. Krishna's made, perhaps it's some test. Perhaps it's some way that we need to surrender, or something that we need to learn. And it may be that we're holding on to a material attachment, and Krishna's pulling it away from us, so that we can depend upon Him, surrender to Him. There's so many ways that Krishna may be working, and we can see it. If we have those eyes and if we have that consciousness to try to see how is Krishna working? What is Krishna doing for me? Sometimes we understand it later. That's the other thing I've noticed, that sometimes we reflect upon it. Something happened, you know, some time ago, and now I understand how Krishna had a plan. But seeing Krishna's plan, seeing Krishna working, seeing Krishna's protection is definitely a way that we understand Krishna at our stage. So that's a very, very good point, that we may not see Krishna directly face to face, but we see Him through His workings. In the same ways we see His energy, we see that energy. That's actually the energy of bhakti that we see. We see working. That internal potency is there. Trivikram Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. Very nice class. So we are saying that He can see with our material eyes. When He was present.
The question was, if we cannot see Krishna with our material eyes, what about when Krishna was present on this planet 5,000 years ago? Actually, Prabhupada explained, I don't know where it was, in some purport or some class, he said, when Krishna was here, maybe 50 people understood He was God. In other words, 50 pure devotees, associates of His, may understand. In other words, even when Krishna appears, They, you know, what does Krishna say? You know, fools deride me when I descend in this human form. They do not know me, right? So in other words, even Krishna says that in the Bhagavad Gita. People don't understand him, even when he does descend in this human form. So, yeah, it takes spiritual eyes even to see Krishna when he's walking in front of us face to face. Otherwise, we'll just see, oh, this is a coward boy, this is a king, this is some material form. Yeah, that's a good point. Prangavendra Prabhu.
That's a very nice class, Prabhu. I always like your class. Srila Prabhupada on the Krishna book, when Lord Krishna was taking Arjuna to rescue the children of Brahmana, and on the way to Mahavishnu's place, Arjuna saw impersonal Brahman and he paid obeisances. So then that question I was tracing, Prabhupada cannot do mistake translation, but then I was tracing about it, and Sanatana Goswami Pad writes, it's a similar thing Prabhupada says in Nectar of Devotion. He says, some or other, when one establishes continuous relationship in the mind, that continuous relationship is remembrance, or in other words, every direct perception of the Bhagavan has to have a background called relationship. If the relationship is established, then he can see everything is connected with the Lord. That then the direct perception will be realized and experienced.
So you're saying, let me make sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying that the direct perception of the Lord comes through
the relationship. With the Lord.
And what were you talking about, like the spiritual understanding or background?
Like Arjuna saw the impersonal Brahman.
Yeah.
But he paid obeisances.
Okay.
So Prabhupada put that in the Krishna.
So
the question
is,
who did he
pay? A personal relationship even with the Brahman, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Because the Brahman he saw is directly emanating from the Lord's form.
Right.
So he paid obeisances to the Brahman, but actually he paid obeisances to Krishna, because they're inseparable.
Yeah, that's a good example. That's very nice. Yeah. By the way, that just reminded me, the best description I've ever heard of Brahman from a Vaishnava perspective and the attraction of Brahman is in the Brihadbhagavatamrita. Remember when he's traveling through and he becomes very attracted, it's almost like he almost gets pulled into it. And he's explaining the attractions there in Brahman, but then of course he realizes, you know, this is not the goal, and goes on. But it's an interesting, you know, Sanatana Goswami is actually telling us what the Brahman is like. Well, you know, like from direct realization, very very interesting.
I have one more thing.
Okay.
You made a very nice point.
I think all the devotees should hear this class here. That while we join in Krishna consciousness, we are progressing. But if somebody do not have a relationship through Guru, spiritual master, then his realization and relishment in the Krishna consciousness is reflection, is not shadow. So why shadow is better? So Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives in Jaya Bhadrama the shadow cannot exist by its own right without the substance.
Yeah.
So because the shadow is only coming from the person, the relationship with the Lord, then even though he may not progress very dramatic or maybe not feeling, but still it is not lost. Eventually he will come to that substance because the shadow has direct relationship.
Yeah.
But the reflection has no direct relationship. So those who are not like seeing through Prabhupada or their spiritual master, they will be deprived because eventually it may vanish because reflection through the mirror, if I smash the mirror, I will not achieve any substance there.
Yeah. It's interesting. We'll have to talk more about, you know, shadow and reflection and these different things. You know, it's interesting. By the way, Rupa Goswami does say in his reading that even with these types of attachments, one still gains liberation and that one has a good chance of going on to deeper levels of bhakti. So it's not that we deride people that have these incomplete, you know, we just want to encourage them to get the more complete realizations. Yeah. Okay, Madame Mahan.
I was just remembering also that how we're learning to connect everything to Krishna. That's the nutshell verse in the Bhagavatam, the Etavadeva Jignatvam. One has to connect everything. up to Krishna, then it says directly and indirectly. And Vishwanath Chakravarti, again, he points out that directly is your sadhana. So we're learning through our sadhana how to connect everything to Krishna, and then indirectly is those things that won't connect you to Krishna, or the non-sadhana things. And then, of course, he translates the etavad up to, means prema, how to connect everything, because your sadhana
means up to prema, right?
Because that's what your sadhana is to do, is to bring you up to that.
So in other words, if we're seeing everything directly and indirectly, but indirectly is kind of like seeing nescience or seeing maya. And to,
well, I always took it like that, the Sri Upanishad, once you know the process of nescience
and transcendence, interesting, thank you, that's good. Well, really nice points everybody's making. I really appreciate your additions to the class. One more in the back, and then we should probably end.
In Janmastami's question, you said something about we can experience through protection many ways that we see Krishna has a hand in our life, and sometimes it takes reflection, but sometimes we sort of sense it. So is there some element of intuition in Krishna consciousness where we have some idea to turn left or right here depending on our feel of Krishna?
Well, that's a very interesting question, a question about what is intuition. Of course, we'd have to look into that a little bit more and see where intuition fits into, like, sort of the spiritual, you know, vocabulary in our philosophy. But one thing that I would say is spiritual intuition means being connected with Supersoul. In other words, you know, Krishna's giving us direction through the heart, through Supersoul. So if our intuition is spiritually, more, you know, spiritually oriented, it means that we'll be hearing from Supersoul, and that will give us direction on which way to go. Prabhupada said that one time. He would often say that people, like, devotees would write kind of dumb questions, you know, things like, come on, figure this out yourself. And he would say, like, use your intelligence. And he would also say, you know, use your intelligence and, you know, you'll be guided by Supersoul to know which way to go. And of course, we know that the intelligence is right next door to the Supersoul, right? Prabhupada said that. In other words, real intelligence means the ability to distinguish matter and spirit. And Prabhupada also said the intelligence is the form direction of Supersoul. So in other words, the way that the Supersoul will manifest to us personally is through the intelligence. And will give it, which I think is, I'm just kind of expanding on your idea of intuition. Maybe that's what it really is. It's the spiritual intelligence, you know, and that'll give us the right direction. Okay? Well, very last one. We got to end.
Jadarani, when she was doing book distribution, asked Prabhupada if there was a chapter that she could chant in Bhagavad Gita that would help her a lot in Sankirtan, and he recommended chapter 13, which is all about Supersoul. Because if you have really good sadhana, you chant really good rounds, Krishna gives you so much intelligence.
Right.
It's so perceivable with book distribution.
Yeah.
But in any circles, really.
Sure. Okay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.